Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Doug Tribou.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And most of us are pretty familiar with the principles that guide the U.S. criminal justice system. Defendants are considered innocent unless they're proven guilty. The jury gives a verdict solely based on evidence submitted in court. Then a judge hands down a sentence.
But when parole boards are considering whether to release convicted criminals before their sentence is complete, the standards are much less clearly defined.
In a newly published report from the Marshall Project and the Washington Post, Beth Schwartzapfel writes, hearsay, rumor, and instincts are all fair game.
Schwartzapfel is a staff writer for the Marshall Project, a nonpartisan news organization that reports on the U.S. criminal justice system. Her story, which came out after months of investigation, is called Life Without Parole, came out on Friday, and she joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So listeners may think about some of these issues that we have, and I'd like to get you started with what were the big findings? What set you off looking into this story?
Well, I'd written a number of stories over the years about people who had been convicted of crimes and were in this sort of later stages of the process and were trying to get parole. And I saw a number of times people who had really done a lot of work towards rehabilitating themselves and had a lot of family support on the outside, people who you would think would be great candidates for parole, get denied with maybe one line of explanation. And, you know, if you think about working towards something for 25 years and then getting told no, you know, in 10 words or less, it can be devastating. And it made me start wondering how it is that that could be the case. And so I started looking into parole boards in all 50 states and found that they're not bound by really any of the standard rules of the criminal justice system. Inmates have no due process rights before parole boards. They're not required to abide by any sort of open records laws that most government agencies are required to abide by, so they can operate in many states in total secrecy and make decisions for almost any reason.
I want to ask you to give us an example where a parole board's decision could have seemed arbitrary to an outside observer.
Well, you know, it's hard to call it arbitrary because, you know, there's always a reason. A lot of times these are, you know, if this is somebody who's convicted of a violent crime, the answer will be, you know, that your crime was violent and therefore we're not going to let you out. So, you know, for a Joe average member of the public, that sounds reasonable. But what I hear from people all the time is, you know, two people, almost identical crimes, almost identical circumstances. You know, no two crimes are identical, but they both do the same work. One guy gets out, the other one doesn't. And a lot of times what it depends on is it depends on the state, but some states, you know, say the parole board has 10 people on it, maybe two or three will hear your case at a time. So it's a crapshoot which two or three parole board members you're going to get. And some of them might have, say, a social work background or have been a defense attorney before they came on the board. They're much more likely to be sympathetic and to vote yes. And then the next guy comes before the three people who all three are former prosecutors, say, or former police officers, mm-hmm. and so they vote no. So, you know, there's countless examples of things like that. And, you know, it does, once you kind of take a wide angle lens, start to seem more arbitrary.
I want to invite our listeners to join this conversation. Should there be set standards for deciding whether someone deserves parole? Should parole boards be more transparent? And are there alternatives? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Beth, what are some of the tools and guidelines that parole boards can use to determine when someone should be released? I was surprised how wide-ranging it is, that there's really not a set thing working here.
Sure. Well, the criminal justice system in general in recent years has turned very often to risk assessment tools, which are these sort of quantitative way of determining whether somebody's at risk of committing a new crime. Sometimes they're based on actuarial data, and they'll gather information like what's your criminal history, how old are you, you know, and they'll look at other people who are in similar circumstances and sort of crunch all these numbers to come up with some kind of, you know, prediction of how likely you are to commit another crime. Some parole boards use them. Other parole boards don't. Some parole boards validate them, meaning they actually check to see if they do what they're supposed to do. Other parole boards don't. But in almost every case, even parole boards that use excellent risk assessment tools, there's two problems. One is that their predictive power comes from things that judges already know when they sentence the person. So your criminal history is the biggest predictor of whether you're going to commit another another crime. Well, the judge knew your criminal history when he or she sentenced you. So you could argue, like, what's the point of the parole board, you know, looking at that again 25 years later? But the other problem is that because parole boards don't have to follow any particular guidelines in making their decisions, the risk assessment is advisory. So even if people have an excellent risk assessment score, the board can still say, well, you just don't seem sorry enough to me, so I'm going to deny you parole. And they're well within their rights to do that.
I think it's worth noting here that the scope of this is pretty immense. I mean, we're talking about 1.5 million people behind bars in the U.S., the highest incarceration rate in the world. And a big part of that, aside from the case-by-case sort of ethics and morals, is also a financial cost.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, incarcerating somebody costs, in many cases, more than it costs to send somebody to a private college. And, you know, every year you keep somebody in prison is a year that the state is spending tens of thousands of dollars on that person. Whereas if they were out in the community, you know, they would be paying taxes and working and, you know, actually be contributing to the community. So it's not without its costs to keep people in prison.
I want to take a closer look at the Massachusetts Parole Board, and we're happy to welcome in Leslie Walker. She's the Executive Director at Prisoners Legal Services of Massachusetts. Thanks for coming in, Leslie.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you give us your assessment in the big view, the 10,000-foot view of the Massachusetts Parole Board? How effective is it? How transparent is it?
Compared to other states, it's good, but it could be even better. Some of the states that Beth references are just horrific with, you know, 100 hearings a day. The parole board structure, by statute, is 7 people, and they hold open hearings. They have to have, I think, 5 members at a hearing for a second-degree lifer, or if some of these juvenile life without parole cases now, they're having hearings. And they can go on for hours, and the public is welcome. They have to report a decision, a written decision, and post it on their website. So that's for the second-degree lifers and this small group of juvenile life without parole men and one woman. The other hearings are not open. There's no right to counsel. There's a very brief decision written. And those, as the crimes become less serious, the board will go from 7 or 5 to 3 or 2 or even 1. And the houses of correction often just have 1 parole officer. And those go pretty quickly. Those are 15-minute or so hearings. And the prisoner will get a 1-paragraph decision. The lifer hearings now, under the current chair, Charlene Bonner, who's very, very good, very good, people get a direct directive about what they have to do during the time that they're sent back to prison. You know, if you're going back for 2 years, you need to do criminal justice work, you need to do a drug program, you need to see a counselor. And it gives people hope. It's also a clarity and direction that is very helpful.
And I should point out on a national basis, that's very rare. A lot of times prisoners will say, I have no idea what the parole board wants from me. You know, they'll say, you haven't done enough time. Or they'll say, you know, you haven't completed enough rehabilitative programs. And then they'll come back however many years later and with more programs under their belt. And then the parole board will say, oh, your crime was too serious. So that is something that I heard from a lot of people, that they don't understand what the parole board wants from them.
Just raise one quick thing while
sure,
we're talking about
of course.
This. I don't know what the exact number is currently for the Department of Correction, but the last time they reported the percentage of their budget that was spent on all programming, including training, job training, reentry, and education, was 2.09% of the budget. So when people are sent back with what's called a setback, your parole's denied, you have to participate in these programs, they are often unavailable. And it's very frustrating for people who want to participate in a program that is not available at their prison. We know of one gentleman who was told, you need some more domestic violence training. You need to see mental health at your prison. Come back after you've done that. He went to mental health, and they said, if you're not in crisis, we can't see you. So he's unable to accommodate that. Governor Baker campaigned on, one of the many issues he campaigned on, was more programming in prisons, and we really look forward to him delivering on that promise.
I want to turn back to you, Beth, and talk about a major case here in 2010 here in Massachusetts, the case involving Dominic Sinelli. Tell us about what happened and how that affected the view of the parole board here in this state.
Sure. Dominic Sinelli was serving a life sentence for a murder, and he had served decades in prison. And he came before the board and really seemed remorseful. He had done a drug habit and had committed these crimes in the course of trying to feed this drug habit, and, you know, was very involved in NA and seemed, you know, by all appearances to be an excellent candidate for parole. And he was granted parole unanimously, which is saying something. And then he went out and, you know, nobody knows exactly what happened. But I think it was 2 years later, he went to rob a jewelry store coming up on Christmas and tragically killed a police officer in the course of robbing this jewelry store. So, of course, public attention turned to the parole board. How could they possibly let this man go? But an investigation by the Executive Office of Public Safety found, in fact, that they didn't blame the board. The board basically used the information they had to determine that he should, you know, was not at high risk for committing another crime. You know, you can't predict human behavior with perfect accuracy. And the problem in this case was that his parole officer was not actually following up with him often enough. But, you know, the public sort of demands action in these cases. And because parole boards are appointed by governors, governors feel like they need to, you know, be decisive when something like this happens. And so Governor Patrick basically forced the entire board to resign. And the new board, you watched the parole rates drop almost in half after this happened. Now, you know, one really understands the public's reaction to this. How could the parole board let somebody go who then goes on to kill somebody else? But everyone who works in parole says it's inevitable. Anybody who's committed a crime, anybody just period, whether we've committed a crime or not, is at risk for committing another crime. You just can't, you don't have a looking glass to know who's going to commit another crime. Firing the parole board sends this message that we should be as conservative as possible. Just don't let anybody out. That's the safest thing to do. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing parole boards who sort of heed that experience as a warning. And if there's ever a call where they're not totally sure, they just say no, because there's nothing in it for them to say yes.
But in fairness to the parole board, I mean, I think that number dropped from 42% release rate to 26%. So they're still releasing a quarter of the people. And it seems like I'm sure the victim's family would say maybe it's worth that hedge.
Certainly, you could argue that, you know, we should keep everybody in prison forever because that would be the safest thing to do. But, you know, if you follow that logic to the conclusion, you know, we have laws in place that make people eligible for parole at a certain point. If you think that somebody who's committed a murder should never get out of prison, no matter what, then legislators should go back and change the laws. But if the laws are such that, you know, if you do certain work and you earn your, you know, parole, that you get out, then there's inevitably going to be risk. There just always is.
Our guests are Beth Schwartzapfel, who is a staff writer for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that covers the criminal justice system, and Leslie Walker, the executive director at Prisoners Legal Services of Massachusetts. I'd like to go to the phones, and you can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Theo is calling from Dorchester. Theo, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to say that Sinelli case sent a family member of mine back another 10 years. It's 30 years now. 30 years. Model inmate, go up to parole board, unanimous decision, and then something always happens. This situation happens, and he can't even get past the parole board, let alone trying to get his sentence commuted. It's pretty awful. And then every time a new governor comes in, I just sit back and say, okay, it's going to be another 4 or 8 years, depending on how long they're going to be in office. Because a governor would allow commutations to sit, and they're not going to do anything, and then they just write a letter, oh, no fault of your own, just start all over again, and you have to go through the parole board. And then when you go through the parole board, like, they're not letting anybody out.
Can I ask you what your brother was convicted of?
I can't remember the name. When someone commits a crime and you're with them, I forgot what they call it. I'm so sorry.
Accessory?
He was with somebody when the crime happened and someone died.
Okay. Thank you for the call, Theo. Leslie, I'd like to let you respond to that. Is that a common story? Is that something that you hear a lot?
Yeah, it's very frustrating. As I said earlier, though, things have gotten a little better in the last 8 months, 10 months since Dr. Bonner was appointed the chair of the parole board. The numbers are definitely coming up, although they're not posted anywhere yet. Anecdotally, the LIFER hearings have gotten much more civil. People are given hope. The setbacks are not automatically 5 years every time, like this woman's brother. Setbacks can be 2 years or 3 years with direction about what else to do. But they are saying yes to people that are, as Beth says, there's always going to be risk. Parole is a risk business. But with good screening instrument and good parole supervision, and I don't mean the trail 'em, nail 'em, and jail 'em. You know, you spit on the sidewalk, you're going back. I mean, parole officers that are committed to having people make it in society, helping them get jobs, helping them get housing, supporting them, they become taxpaying citizens. Parole works when it's done well, and we are quite capable of doing it well in Massachusetts. We just have a long way to go.
One of the things that was interesting to me in your report, Beth, was the unintended consequence of having someone serve their full term but then get out without qualifying for parole. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So when somebody gets a parole eligible sentence, they're given a range of years. So a judge will sentence them to, say, 5 to 10 years or 25 years to life. And once they've served what's called their min, which is the lower of those numbers, they're eligible for parole. But the board can continue to deny them all the way up to their max, up to their max out date is what it's called. And once you hit your max out date, the state can no longer supervise you. They lose their legal ability to have any control over you. So if the parole board thinks you're too dangerous to parole and keeps saying no, 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 you hit your max date and you walk out of prison with no supervision whatsoever. And so it's this irony of the parole process that the people that the parole board deems most dangerous are the ones who are getting out with no supervision.
Let's take another call. Walter is calling from Walpole. Walter, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Walter, calling from Walpole. My daughter is serving a 15-year-to-life term in West Virginia for a very, very, very serious crime, just about as serious as you can get it. She was eligible for parole last summer after having served 15 years, pretty much a model prisoner. She's serving in an all-women's prison, the Lakin Correctional Institute in West Virginia. That's L-A-K-I-N. Number one, there are three men on the board in an all-women's prison, hearing all-women prisoners plead their paroles. Number two, of the three, one, instead of reviewing... Hello?
Yes, we're still here.
Oh, okay, thank you. One, instead of reviewing her particular situation, relitigated her case from 15 years previous, reading from old testimony. And number one, we were scheduled to get on at 11 o'clock in the morning. We didn't get there until she didn't get her parole heard until 3:30 in the afternoon. They wanted to go home, period. It took them approximately half an hour to decide that she wasn't eligible for parole.
Walter, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your call. I want to turn to Beth. Tell us how this plays into what you've uncovered.
Actually, it's interesting that you brought up how long you were waiting. There has been some research that unbelievably shows that how favorably a parole board will look on an applicant changes before and after lunch. That if you've recently, no, seriously, if you're leading up to lunch, you're less likely to grant parole than after lunch. Yeah. And, you know, it sounds crazy, but if you think about it, it's just, you know, humans. And when we give humans the ability to sort of rely on their gut instincts to decide whether somebody is rehabilitated or not, you know, that's inevitably going to result. I mean, you get grumpy when you're hungry, so you're probably less likely to, cut anyone any slack.
I want to note that we did reach out to the Massachusetts Parole Board for this interview, but they were unable to provide anyone for the segment. And I want to also go back to another issue that we touched on a little bit earlier. In 2013, the Supreme Judicial Court struck down life sentences without parole for juveniles tried as adults. At that time, Sean Aylward spoke out about his sister, Beth Brody. She was beaten to death with a baseball bat by a 16-year-old in the early 1990s. And Sean Aylward said, quote, "In order for this to happen, they have to bring this up like this and drag our family back through the whole situation 20 odd years later is painful." Leslie, what would your response be to families that feel like the rug is being pulled out from under them when they think a certain term has been imposed?
I think it must be devastating, but I do think people can be made to understand with a lot of support and patience that things change. Brain science changes. People learn if the Supreme Court, which is hardly a liberal body, understands the brain science and says that people are not considered as responsible, they're too impulsive, their prefrontal cortex is not formed, then they need to be treated differently because they were children when they were sent to prison for natural life. It's difficult to hear for a victim's family member, but I think a district attorney sitting down and explaining to them that this person actually now has a legal right, it's going to be difficult for them, and the DA can certainly apologize, but say, we have to go through this process because we're here to obey the law, and this is what the law is, and we'll support you through every stage of this proceeding. And then on the flip side of that is, of course, is restorative justice, which many families would benefit tremendously from having a conversation with a now adult who is so remorseful for what they did as a child. Instead of keeping the vengeance and the anger going, there could be some healing on both sides.
Beth, I want to ask you in closing about the something that I found myself thinking about today as we're preparing for this, the difference between the violent and the nonviolent offenders. What is the trickle-down effect to the drug dealer who's been in for 15 years versus someone who actually committed a crime with a gun or something violent where someone was seriously hurt or killed?
I definitely think, especially now in this political climate where, you know, mass incarceration has become like a term du jour and more people are becoming aware of how many people the U.S. locks up relative to other developed countries, people are becoming more and more comfortable with shorter terms for nonviolent drug offenders or even alternatives to incarceration for nonviolent drug offenders. President Obama just commuted the sentences of, I think, 43 people serving very long terms for drug crimes. I think there's a tentative national consensus of that nonviolent criminals should not be serving long prison terms. I think we're a long ways from being more comfortable with, you know, realizing that people who committed violent crimes can change too. And I think that's the hard thing that parole boards are dealing with. Because they're political bodies, they're inevitably going to be responsive to what the public thinks, and the public's not there yet.
Beth, just very quickly, do you see a move toward more standardization, more change at parole boards around the country?
I definitely see some moves towards professionalism. There's some federal money for training for parole boards. But I think until there's transparency and accountability built into the system, it's going to be fits and starts.
Beth Schwartzapfel is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. For a link to her piece on parole boards, you can visit our website, radioboston.org. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Leslie Walker is executive director at Prisoners Legal Services of Massachusetts. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll hear about tick-borne illnesses other than Lyme disease to watch out for this summer. I'm Doug Tribou with Anthony Brooks, and this is Radio Boston.